Do you ever get annoyed with sin? And you might want to think about that, because it kind of depends as to whether you're talking about sin in me or sin in others, or both. Because I'm sure there isn't anyone who would say, well, I don't get annoyed with sin in me so much, but I really get annoyed with sin in somebody else. But we may want to be thinking about it in terms of both of those. There was a survey some time back by the BBC in which they were evaluating or considering the problems that people indicated as the biggest problems that we have to deal with. And it had been on the top of the list to have the environment and world peace as a couple of the major ones, but not all that long ago, those two had been displaced by another problem. That other problem was noted as corruption. Corruption. I thought that was interesting, because corruption is another sanitized way of saying sin. There is a problem with that. And it's almost an admission of what the Bible refers to and we understand to be total depravity, which is obviously a significant problem as well. I wonder if we feel comfortable these days calling sin what it is, sin, because many don't. Many prefer not to use it and prefer not to think about it. But part of our character, part of what makes us what we are, has to do with how we deal with sin, or maybe if we deal with sin. Do we admit it, confess it, deal with it? Do we deny it, reject it, ignore it? Which is it? And do we ever come up with reasonable excuses for our sin? Of course we do. We rationalize sin in many ways all the time. And we aren't the first to do so. Or we may not even see it, that we're actually doing it. But we want to examine a character this morning, a biblical character, as we've been looking at some biblical characters throughout some of the Old Testament and trying to think about the issue of character in their experience, and think about one who has been associated with a particular character flaw, and wonder whether or not that is an accurate assessment. And so we want to think about, well, this whole matter of corruption, that it's evil, but getting beyond that, to consider the value of character analysis. Is there value in analyzing character? Now, anyone who has ever worked probably anywhere knows that that's one of the things that is considered in any job position. What kind of character are you? And many of us could have a variety of responses to that. I know some of you are some real characters. I know I can be a real character, so I understand that. But in the job interview process, one of the things that's going to be involved is trying to assess what kind of person are you, and are you the right person for this job? And part of that has to do with your character. What is the nature of your character? And we analyze people all the time, whether we do so consciously or unconsciously, we do so. And so as we think about the problem of deceit, which is our topic of consideration from these passages in the book of Genesis, I want us to think about where does this come from? Obviously, we have the passing along of the sin nature and all of that, but there's something in particular. When we look at Genesis chapter 27, and I'm not going to take a look at it all just now, but just to be reminded, this is the passage where Jacob, from the encouragement of his mother, Rebekah, is intentionally going to take the blessing from Esau. A very intentional element of deceit is taking place. That's sort of the centerpiece here. And so we want to think about, how did they get to this place? Is there anything that is part of the influencing factors? And so that's what we want to think about. First of all, the heritage influence. What do we know about Abraham and Isaac, grandfather and father? Did they ever do anything that could have been seen as maybe influencing this? Do you remember the passage in Genesis 12:13, where Abram, due to a famine, went down with his wife to Egypt to wait out the famine? And what did Abram say to his wife Sarai at the time? "Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you." So was that telling the truth? Well, we know there's this half-truth thing, as we'll see in a moment. That didn't come out in this passage, but in the next one it does. And so this comes after Genesis 12, 1 through 3, where God said to him, "I'm going to make you a great name, a great nation, and the whole world is going to be blessed through you." And how can this one who has had this encounter with God now come to a place where he's feeling like he needs to come up with telling a falsehood for self-preservation? It's almost as if this one who supposedly is trusting God isn't trusting God. I guess we kind of fit in that categorization to some degree. We consider ourselves as those who trust God, and yet we find ourselves in positions sometimes where we do things that would indicate that we don't trust God. How can that be? Yet Abraham was recognized as a man of faith, chapter 15, verse 6. Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. So Abram learned his lesson, right? Like the rest of us. No. He eventually finds himself in the area where Abimelech was in charge of things. And so Genesis 20 in verse 2 says, "Now Abraham said to Sarah, his wife," of course his name had been changed by this time because he had gone through the covenant procedure in chapter 15, and his name was changed, and Sarai's name was changed to Sarah, and he said, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah, and you recall how that story went. And Abimelech was threatened by God in the night, and then went to Abram and said, "What are you trying to do to me? I am innocent here. What is going on?" And so twice Abraham fell in that trap. And you would think that would be the end of it. Two times, and that's enough. Oh, and then there was Isaac, who also had an encounter with Abimelech, who also said the same thing. And the men of the place asked about his wife, and he said, "She is my sister." There must have been a script that was written that everybody used whenever this kind of scenario came along, because it seemed to be pretty common. For he was afraid to say, "She is my wife," because he thought, "Lest the men of the place kill me for Rebekah, because she is beautiful to behold." So there was a cultural climate that seemed to have caused this, because people seemed to be in the position of stealing other people's wives or killing them in order to take them. Basic lawlessness, wickedness going on. And there was this habit pattern, it seemed, established for deceit. And it seemed to be passed on, whether intentionally or not. It causes me to think about the passage in Titus chapter 1 and verse 12, where Paul is quoting a poet. He says, one of them, a poet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. What makes you wonder? The patriarchs were always liars. I don't think I want to take it quite that far, but you kind of wonder, you know, what's going on here? It makes you wonder about what could be said of us. What things do we do that seem to be sort of necessary in order to survive in our culture because of the way things are, that we adjust what scriptural expectations are so that we can survive in our culture? Are we guilty of that? Can you think of anything? What do you have to do to be able to exist? How do you have to adjust your finances in order to survive in our culture? Are there things that we feel that we're required to do in order to make it in our world? Could such rash generalizations or characterizations be said of us, as Paul said of the Cretans? I hope not, but it could be. How are we characterized? As Americans. I mean, y'all, if you have to do is go overseas and talk to a few people, and they'll tell you what they think of Americans, whether good or bad. It was interesting when we were in one of the souvenir shops on Starry Arbot Street that the gal that was helping us said, "You're Americans. I can tell because you always smile." Because that seemed to be unusual. That's a characterization that I can handle. But there are some other ones that I would feel a little uncomfortable with. But what about us Christians? Now, I don't know how familiar you are with the history of the IFCA. It originally was Independent Fundamental Churches of America. And earlier on in the history, they were a little bit known for standing strong and not necessarily working with others around them because of their intent on being consistent with Scripture. And so they were known for being a little bit feisty and separatistic. And so somewhere along the way, someone had come up with the acronym that IFCA stands for I Fight Christians Anywhere. That's not a good characterization. It doesn't have to just apply to the IFCA. It could apply to anybody, but that's just a characterization that had been made at one point. I think that is no longer the case, but that was an early characterization, at least by some. Are we characterized in some fashion as that? I don't think that would be a good thing. Well, what about as an individual? Have you ever wondered what one simple phrase would best describe you? A fun-loving person? A serious person? A happy person? A gloomy person? A devout person? Or a terrible person? A good person? Or a scary person? A delightful person? Or a deceptive person? An untrustworthy person? Or a trustworthy person? It helps to think through that from time to time. What would most accurately characterize me if I could come up with some phrase? Is how I would describe myself on my resume consistent with how I really am? And then let's come back to Jacob. Is the characterization that's made of him, or even of Rebecca, correct or consistent? Which brings us to the next point, the environmental influence. Several things could be included here. I'm just using that in the terms of what was he around, that is, what was Jacob around that might have influenced him, and his mother certainly was one who was there. There are certain things that we can observe as it relates to his mother. Rebekah had some difficulties with the birth process. Genesis 25:21 says, "Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived, but the children struggled together within her." So there was some early fighting going on in that particular case. She also knew the prophecy that was made. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." That was a prophecy. Did it require them to make it happen? Or would it have happened in the Lord's way had it been allowed to transpire? And so we have Jacob taking the first step. In verse 31, it says, "But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day." So this is where Jacob essentially manipulated his brother to get the birthright by giving him something to eat so he wouldn't starve to death. At least that's how he perceived it. That is how Esau perceived it. At this point, it seems to be without provocation. We don't have evidence that his mother said, "Now go and do this," like she did later. We don't know. Maybe she did, or maybe she had told him that he needed to. Don't know. We do know that Rebekah had planned for Jacob's deception of Isaac. And there were many problems in that family. It's what we would call a dysfunctional family to a significant degree. Verse 28 says, "Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob." That could be a little bit of a problem. It was a little bit of a problem. So Isaac came across as a passive and partial father. Rebekah came across as a manipulative, deceptive, and partial mother. I would direct your attention to Genesis 27, verses 6 through 13. Where we read, "So Rebekah spoke to Jacob her son, saying, 'Indeed, I heard your father speak to Esau your brother, saying, bring me game and make savory food for me, that I may eat it and bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to what I command you. Go now to the flock and bring me there two choice kids of the goats, and I will make savory food from them for your father, such as he loves. Then you shall take it to your father, that he may eat it and that he may bless you before his death.'" She's thinking about the prophecy that was made, and she was also perhaps thinking about how she liked Jacob better than Esau. And Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Look, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth-skinned man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I will seem to him to be a deceiver to him." Surely not. That doesn't say that. "I shall bring a curse on myself and not a blessing." But his mother said, "Let your curse be on me." That sounds familiar. Didn't somebody else say that? When the Jews were in the process of wanting to crucify Christ, they said, "Let his blood be upon us and our children." It's a dangerous thing to do. "Let your curse be on me, my son. Now only obey my voice and go and get them." And so he did. Did he have to? Oh, then he's in a difficult spot. Do you obey your mother or deceive your father? And deceive your father, or do you obey what you know you should do? That's a tough situation to be in. Is it really that tough, though, depending on what your focus is? Well, then there was Esau. 25 verse 32 says, "Esau said, 'I'm about to die. What use is birthright to me?' When he was needing to eat something because he had been out hunting. and was starved. He seemed a bit self-focused, and he seemed to be a bit short-sighted. In Hebrews 12 and verse 16, Paul refers to him, that's my bias coming out. Whoever the author of Hebrews is, I think it's Paul, but calls him a profane man. That is referring to him as a spiritual outsider. And then Jacob is a manipulative and deceptive son, a little bit like his mother in this case. Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn." Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done..." You don't have to read anymore. That's enough. The deception was premeditated. Was there any good reason to do it? Was it necessary? They seem to be convinced that they needed to. It's one of those things that we can't go back and see how it would have turned out if they had let it go and see if Isaac would have handled it himself. Would he have just intuitively or from the Lord known to do that? Interesting to contemplate. But we can't live in the world of speculative theology, so it was predicted, that is, that the older would serve the younger, but the act was freely carried out. Reminds me of Judas. Judas was predicted to be the one who would betray Christ, but he freely did it on his own. It involved a deliberate and a complex deception in terms of pulling everything off. And God chose Jacob in spite of his significant deficiencies. Now that ought to be something that we think about. What kind of a person was Jacob? Was he a good guy? Why did God choose him? It kind of makes you think, well, maybe there's hope for us. Go back to Romans 9, 10 to 13, and check that out as a reminder. Did it require deception? Well, we won't know for sure, but I suspect that it probably didn't, but that's how it turned out. But you could also argue that Judas didn't need to betray Christ, but somebody did, and he did. There's something you can spend a little time contemplating. Then there is the internal influence. Was there a heart of deceit in Jacob, as has been argued in some cases? His name means he takes by the heel, or supplanter, or heel snatcher, or he cheats. Genesis 25, 26 references the name that he was given. And then Esau referred to his name and to his cheating. He said, "Your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing." And Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing." And he's feeling a bit cheated in the process, because Jacob had effectively stolen the birthright by manipulation, and had deceitfully stolen the blessing with the help of his mother, or the encouragement of his mother. And then down the road, Jacob was going to wrestle with God when his name was changed in Genesis 32:28. It says, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. You have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." The picture I have in my mind is that Jacob had some rough edges that needed to be smoothed off. And it took some work. And he had a limp to remember that when you struggle against God, there are consequences. And we may have some of those experiences as well when we resist what God desires from us. There may be a little bit of Jacob in all of us. whether we'd like to admit it or not. And we do well to evaluate our own character from time to time. So, with that in view, consider the danger of deceit calluses. The hardness that happens when you continue to do something over and over. The problem of perpetuation. Effective deceit breeds more deceit. It may seem to pay off. You may get away with it for a time. It seems to get easier as the conscience becomes more seared, as you become more comfortable, as it becomes more useful. And there can be a habit that develops. It can happen in many different things. This is one in particular. Perpetuated deceit may bring a return of deceit. You get a little bit of your own medicine. Jacob discovered that with Laban, who was to become his father-in-law, when Laban switched who he was going to marry and sort of manipulated him into working for him another 7 years to get the wife he was hoping for, and the host of other issues that are part of that scenario. Jacob, in return, had some manipulation that he had engendered, where he had this intentional, at least an intended genetic engineering of the animals to make his possessions grow. A whole other interesting scenario. Perpetuated deceit has consequences. Ask someone by the name of a Mr. Vaughn locally, or a Mr. Madoff nationally, how well this deceit works over time. Works for a while, and then it eventually catches up with you. What were the consequences that Jacob experienced? He had to flee for his life from Esau, who threatened to kill him, and who was intending to as soon as his father passed away. So then he was sent to Laban to find a wife. His mother did some manipulation there to get Isaac to send him there. You see all this stuff going on. He lost contact with his family for a good while. He was estranged from his brother. He was afraid of his brother when he finally had opportunity to meet him again. And then there is this passage in Genesis 31:49. It says, because he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from another. Doesn't that sound like a sweet thing to say to, you know, for a couple when they're away from each other? Do you know what this is actually saying? Because I can't trust you, God watch you when we're not together. That's what it's saying. It said, if you afflict my daughters, or if you take otherwise beside my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. And I have seen that verse used in ways that it ought not to have been used. There was a disposition of distrust that was perpetuated. And that's not a good thing. It's hard to have a relationship when there is distrust in the mix of it. A quick word on the meaning of deceit. The dictionary definition is the act or practice of deceiving, concealment or distortion of the truth for the purpose of misleading, or duplicity, fraud, cheating. Some practical implications. It is the manipulation of facts, acts, or people for your own selfish ends without regard for the consequences to others. Almost sounds like politics, doesn't it? Or the function of governments, whether here or somewhere else around the world. Without a biblical worldview, there is no reason not to do so. The problem is that there are still those who have a biblical worldview who still get sucked into it. And that is a danger. Jacob would certainly have considered himself a believer. And yet look what he was pulled into. Beware of what we may be pulled into. Consider the effects of truth paralysis. The effects of lying and deceit. The effects of truth paralysis, where the truth may be recognized, but it is non-functional. It's not utilized. Sometimes it's not even recognized. So we need to understand the significance of truth. Recognize the centrality of it, first of all. We need to see the importance of it. Remember these words of Jesus to Pilate, John 18, 37, 38. Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" In Pilate's mind, it was a relative thing because of where he was coming from. But Christ said, "This is it. This is why I've come into the world. I should bear witness to the truth." That's central. That's essential. Your worldview is significant here. In a relativistic worldview, we are free to do whatever is best for us, as long as we try to keep the collateral damage to a minimum, and as long as you can get away with it. That's kind of where most of the world is coming from. That seems to be the norm. But there are temporal and there are eternal consequences to this understanding. And that's not the real world. That's a misperception of the real world, because there is absolute truth. In the world of absolute truth, there is always a reckoning for the violation of truth, because there are physical laws that are in place and there are consequences for its violation. I mean, this is Balloon Fiesta week coming up, and we're in the process of it. Some of you may have seen some of them already. But the balloonists know that you cannot violate the laws of physics without consequences. And that's why sometimes they don't fly, because it's really hard to handle and land a balloon when you got a lot of wind, and it's dangerous. And you don't want holes in your envelope and all kinds of other things. There are also spiritual laws that must be reckoned with. The bottom line is communicated in Galatians 6:7. It says, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that will he also reap." Not only in the physical realm, but in the spiritual realm. "He who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life." The margin of error in the moral realm seems to be more fluid, because the consequences may not show up as quickly and may not be evident until it's too late. And that is the danger. That is the danger. Avoid the subversion of truth. We need to resist the denial of truth. Sometimes we don't like to hear what the truth is, and we ignore it or don't give adequate consideration to it. Or we may be like those that Paul was referring to in Romans 1:18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." There's a lot of that going on. There may be more deniers of truth than there are embracers of truth in this world, but that doesn't nullify the truth. The truth is still there. The truth is going to hold sway regardless of whether you embrace it. And that's why we need to escape the peril of truth. The peril of truth is simply that if you ignore it, it's going to hold true regardless. So we ought not to deny it, bend it, neglect it, manipulate it, or anything else, because it will come out ahead. Truth will win, regardless of my understanding of it, regardless of my acceptance of it. So we're better off to recognize it and live it. And then the last point, decide to defeat deceit. The problem is stated in Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? There's a solution. We can get a new heart when we put our faith and trust in Christ. There is hope. And when we have Christ, we have the Holy Spirit in us. We have the means by which to handle things. We have then the standard of truth. We recognize that we are accountable, but we need discernment to know how to apply it, to live it out, and it involves a daily choice to live the truth or accept and live a lie, to practice deceit or to practice the truth. I have a choice every day. I have to deal with that. We need to recognize the impact of truth on character. How do I deal with that? Am I consistently living the truth? Or do I bend it to suit my needs whenever it seems expedient? Beware of those consequences.